force people to grapple with the full breadth of your humanity.
Right.
You'll be respected more for it. You'll be more effective at what you do. And that's actually the only way that you'll be able to be novel in any of the work that you're approaching.
Yeah.
Right? Because it is exactly the intersection of identities, ideas that don't belong,
yeah,
and existing power structures, that the clashing of those two things is what creates like that spark, that new idea.
What makes art.
What makes art.
So JT, thank you first for even agreeing to sit down and do this.
Of course.
I know I had to come across the pond to get to you, but it's fine. It just ended up working out. But today I really want to just capture a lot about your story, right? Again, New Traditional, the platform is oriented to really talk through people that are at intersections, whether it be creative, professionally, personally, and ultimately what those inflection points mean for the next step. So, you know, you as a Rhodes Scholar, as a person before any of that, but also as a musician, where does your story start and where are you now?
Yeah. First off, thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it. My story starts back home, of mm-hmm. course, as it does with anybody. I'm from Northeast Portland, specifically King Alberta, which is a neighborhood that historically has been home to the vast majority of the small black population of mm-hmm. the city. So I grew up in a neighborhood that was predominantly black, in a city, in a state that's predominantly not. And I grew up bouncing back and forth, kind of ping-ponging around these different corners of this really odd, eccentric place. And I think that journey was a really definitive one for me.
Once you left Portland, what was it like for you after that? Was it straight to college? Was there like a year between where you're deciding kind of what was the thought or intuition behind that next step?
Yeah.
College, as we know, isn't for everybody.
Yeah. So my journey to college was actually an odd one. I grew up playing basketball, and mm-hmm. my neighborhood has actually produced a lot of really talented basketball players mm-hmm. who played in the NBA, from Damon Stoudemire, Ime Udoka, Terrell Brandon, Jesus. Terrence Jones, Terrence Ross. And that was something that I tried to carry through my childhood, mm-hmm. and something that really defined my childhood in a lot of ways. So in high school, my main priority was not school in any sense. It was hooping. I wanted to be an NBA basketball player. And I wanted to go to college, not necessarily for an education, but more so as a stepping stone to that ultimate goal, which mm-hmm. was playing in the NBA. So, as you might imagine, my focus was elsewhere. Right? I didn't perform too well in school. But I was doing really well basketball-wise. A couple of things shook out. The short end of it is I ended up getting injured. When I got injured, I came back too early, re-aggravated the injury. There were schools that had offered me scholarships, full-ride scholarships, that then came and saw me play. I was playing on an aggravated injury. You're just not the same player you were anymore. Rescinded the scholarships. And then I was left in a situation where I basically had to figure another way out of my scenario. I just grew up with my mom, so didn't really have money to go to school. It was like, you're going to finance your own education. That was the expectation. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if I hadn't been able to, she would have made something happen. That's the way my mother is. But that was a burden I placed on myself mm-hmm. and that our circumstances placed on me. So I had to turn back to school. When you're being heavily recruited as an athlete, your test scores are effectively public information. So I scored really well on my SATs, but my grades were horrible. I had like a 2.8 GPA, I had D's and F's on my transcript. So all these schools, high ranking academic schools that previously thought I was out of their league basketball wise, once the diminished basketball version of me came onto the scene playing on this aggravated ankle, they were like, oh, yeah, we could get this dude now. He's definitely in our race. So they would start recruiting me. First thing they do, if you're talking to like an Ivy League school, is they request your transcript. Mm-hmm. So they send me all these transcript requests. Like, oh, bro, you could definitely play here. See my transcript. Never talk to me again. Only school that stuck it out with me was actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. They effectively said, listen, there's no way you can get in on these grades next year. This was my junior summer going into my senior year, right? But there is a way, you know, an unorthodox path that you might be able to take if you so choose. It's a risk. There's no guarantees on any end that you're going to have to kind of perform your ass off. But if you're able to do it, there's a chance.
Yeah.
At that point, I was thinking, all right, I'm either going to community college for basketball or I'm doing this, right? So I chose that path. And effectively what it required me to do, I had to go into my counseling office, convince my my college counselor in high school to track me into a full, I went to an IB school, full IB courses. I had been tracked into all level lower courses with the exception of one class. Mm-hmm. Because of the way I performed historically throughout middle school, elementary school, into high school. And then I had to get all A's in every single one of my classes. The grades would be weighted. It would offset, the bad grades on my GPA or on my transcript. And then I also had to retake all the courses I got D's or F's in and get those grades voided off my transcript so they'd be factored out of my GPA. So I was able to do that over the course of my senior year. I didn't get anything but A's and full IB. That resuscitated my GPA to a certain extent. And with that, they were able to get me or help me get into an elite boarding school on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So I went to Choate Rosemary Hall for a fifth year high school. So I graduated from my 4 year high school, public high school in Portland, and then I did a fifth year high school. And that year was explicitly for a school. And that was brutal. That was like one of the toughest years of my life. I felt like I was thrown into an entirely different orbit, an entirely different universe. I thought I had been around wealth before, and I was like, I'm comfortable being around white people because I grew up in this white city, right, in a black neighborhood, but going to school in a white environment, right? So I know how to navigate these people, right? I got to that school and very quickly realized that was not the case, man.
Chump change.
Yeah, it's chump change, man. I'm telling you, you're going to school with people who own, like, the Atlantis resort in the Bahamas, people whose fathers are senators, people whose mothers are billionaires, like ancestral wealth. I had never been in an environment where people were so comfortable flaunting that, or, like, putting that in other people's faces. So I really shut down. I'm a very social person. That was the first time in my life I actually really shut down. But it was good in a sense because, man, that was the most difficult academic experience I ever had. Yeah. That was harder than Yale, that was harder than Oxford, definitely harder than my high school back home. And I don't think if I hadn't had that year, I would have been able to perform as well as I did once I did get to college.
And what was it like in that time? You mentioned that you felt like you, in a way, had to compartmentalize, right, in order to make it through. What did that feel like?
Basketball was a feature of my identity, right? Mm-hmm. It was something that I used to define myself. Oh, who are you? Like, what's your name? Oh, my name's JT Flowers. What do you do? I'm a hooper. Like, that's how I define myself. So straying from basketball meant straying from a part of myself.
Right.
And stepping into that world, academically, socially, meant grappling with parts of myself that I had, you know, prior to that point, not been forced to consider or grapple with. The way I spoke was a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
The way I looked was a disadvantage. The way I dressed was a disadvantage. I remember my first day at Choate, a dude by the name of Colin Lord, C. Lord, we called him. He was an administrator who basically was responsible for making sure kids like me didn't fall through the cracks at Choate. He showed up to my dorm with a plastic, like, grocery bag. I was like, what's in that bag? He's like, yeah, you got 10 shirts. I didn't have any collared shirts to go to class in, and we had a dress code, right? So, I'm coming from where I come from. I wore t-shirts and hoodies every day.
Right.
I wore t-shirts and hoodies.
Yeah.
I maybe copped a cardigan to feel like I was flying by like homecoming or something. But that was probably stolen and still had an H&M tag on it. Like, he was like, here's a bag of 10, 16 shirts that you could wear on a daily basis, right? That man, for our ball there, he bought me my first suit. He bought me my first pair of, like, wingtips. So I had to adjust on a cultural level, on an academic level. I felt like, man, I was sitting in class. I swear I spent probably 60% of my time on my new laptop. No lie. Just Googling words that people were saying. Looking up words in the dictionary. I swear. It was very unsettling. I felt like I was less intelligent than every single person around me. I soon came to realize that that wasn't true for a number of reasons, but it wasn't just about compartmentalizing. I think initially I thought that in order to survive in that environment, I would have to sever entire parts of myself. And I think I actually did go through with that in certain ways. And much of my journey since has been getting back to me, right? Undoing all these things that I tried to teach myself as survival mechanisms, and just being comfortable being wholly and completely myself, unapologetically.
Yeah, a lot of what I've seen in my story, even in kind of in just speaking to you in the few moments that we have, is that a lot of what we learn, right, in institutional settings, that growth really comes from unlearning that, like doing all the work to fit in, doing all the work to kind of be seen, and then to have to come to a point where, you know, it's like, am I going to be me, or am I going to be a little bit of me and some of that, or do you just kind of go full throttle with it? And it sounded like Choate was an inflection point, right, or a point that you had to go full throttle. You said that you felt like you had to sever parts of yourself. What's that process like? Was it something that you were just making decisions based off of what you knew then, or that it's something that you find that was crucial to you being who you are today?
Yeah. Would I say it's the right move? Absolutely not. And what I've done since making it out of situations like the one I came out of is I spent a lot of time trying to help other kids who are similarly positioned. And the main thing I try to communicate is that you don't have to do what I did in order to navigate these institutions effectively, in order to be successful, whatever that means, in these spaces. I was so self-conscious even about the way I spoke. There's a funny-ass interview with me when I was in high school. It was like they caught me out there at a basketball game. And the way I'm speaking, yo, like, you could tell exactly where I'm from, right? But I knew I spoke like that. So when I got into Choate, no lie, like, you asked what that process is like. It's a torturous one. I literally would go into my basement, turn on the TV at night, I started watching the news. I was like, oh shit, I don't know anything about anything. I need to start watching CNN or something. We had just got cable. I was like, okay, I'm lit. I'm gonna watch Anderson Cooper 360. I'm gonna literally watch the way this man speaks.
Wolf Blitzer, my man.
Yeah. Wolf Blitzer. And I'm, no lie, I'm gonna pair it back the way they're speaking. I'm gonna record myself on something so I can hear how I sound. And then I'm going to correct, you know, my speech patterns so that I sound more quote unquote articulate. Really what I was saying is so I speak standard, like white American English better, so that people will respect my ideas. One thing I realized in high school, people really thought I was a dumbass. So when I transferred into full IB, I'll be in classes with all these smart kids, but they had gone to school with me for 3-4 years, right? They really did think I was like a complete idiot. And I was like, oh, that's the basketball player. Like, that dude is a fucking clown. So what I had to do was, I think I came to realize very quickly that my ideas would be dismissed in that context, not because they weren't substantive enough, but because they weren't worded in a way that was accessible for the powers that be, you know, given that particular power structure. So I was like, okay, I have to adhere to that more closely. What I came to realize later is that the proper way to do that would have been to force the powers that be to grapple with the fact that they're dismissing my ideas based on the way that they're formatted rather than based on their substance. Okay. That would have been the proper critique. That would have been the proper way to go about it. That's what I try to encourage young people to do. I also don't fault my younger self for doing that because I didn't really have any guidance or anybody to show me any different way. Yeah. But it wasn't fun by any sense. It's something that I look back on with a great deal of shame. I don't think we as Black people should ever be ashamed of where we come from or who we are or how we are. And we especially shouldn't bend parts of our identity or our humanity in order to be more palatable to whiteness or to the powers that be. And I think that's very much something that I ended up succumbing to.
And now I'm pivoting to that, and we're going to go into access next, but just in a sentence or two, right, to kind of a younger demographic listening to this that may be at those points where they're like, okay, I'm about to get into this top school, or like I have to make that next big decision, and compartmentalizing many times may seem like the only way to do so or to make it through. What would you say to them?
Force people to grapple with the full breadth of your humanity.
Right.
You'll be respected more for it. You'll be more effective at what you do. And that's actually the only way that you'll be able to be novel in any of the work that you're approaching.
Yeah.
Right? Because it is exactly the intersection of identities, ideas that don't belong,
yeah,
and existing power structures, that the clashing of those two things is what creates like that spark, that new idea.
What makes art?
What makes art, mm-hmm, right? So my word to them would be to force people to grapple with that, and to understand that even though it might feel particularly difficult, yeah, at certain points, in the long run, they'll benefit immensely from it and their work will. Well, shit, sometimes they might not benefit. Like, no, I think that's real. I think like, that's important to highlight. Like, yeah, sometimes we might not benefit from it, but I do think that it's a question about the way you want to live life.
Mm-hmm.
And I know sometimes we don't have the privilege of taking that approach, right? I know I've had instances where it's like, okay, I got to make enough money to send home because I know my mom's struggling with this or that. I don't have time to be risking this opportunity, right? I need to do what I came here to do, whatever it takes. If it means cutting off a part of myself, I got to cut off a part of myself, yeah, and do this. You know, as I've accrued privilege,
right,
that kind of, that defiance is something that's become easier and easier to maintain. So yeah, I would encourage people to do that with a caveat, right? And that caveat is understand your circumstances as well, right? Yeah. And don't fault yourself for having to respond to those circumstances.
Fair. So from East Portland to Yale to basketball through the IB program to Rhodes, talk to us briefly about what that segue was, like what the thinking was behind it, less so about what it felt like than what the mentality was or the mindset behind it was.
When I got into Yale, after my year at boarding school, I was a little bit more familiar with the way that whole game worked.
Yep.
And I had been exposed to things that I had never heard of previously. I looked up something. In my mind, I was with one of my friends, her name's Carla. We were sitting there chilling that summer afterwards. And I was like, man, you wouldn't even believe the things these kids value. Like, I'm from, like, people value like hoop scholarships, people who go pro at this, or people who make it big in this field. Like, these people literally value academic scholarships as if they're like Olympic trophies.
Man,
she was like, "Yo, what's the biggest scholarship?" I was like, "I don't know. Let's look it up." No lie, we Google like most famous scholarship or most prestigious scholarship on earth. It was like Rhodes Scholarship. I was like,
that's it.
I'm going to win that.
That's it.
I was like, I'm going to win that. I swear,
yeah,
I'm going to win that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to win that because how fucking crazy would that be to come from where I came from to get to Yale in the way that I got there, yeah, right? I swear, when I was going through the application process, I looked at, you know, those like College Confidential websites. I was like, lowest GPA ever to get into Yale University. And
five,
they had like a bell 5. curve.
I know, yeah.
For real. I was like, oh shit, I'm below the bottom point on this curve.
Yeah.
My GPA is lower than anybody that their data has ever tracked into this university. Yeah?
Yeah.
So how crazy would it be to go from being that person,
mm-hmm,
to a Rhodes Scholar? That's my mission when I get there. That's my mission when I get there at the level of ambition, mm-hmm, at the level of what I wanted to do on it. How I wanted to spend my time, I wanted to make that space more accessible for kids like us, because I understood how crippling that lack of accessibility was for me at Choate. I didn't want other people to have to feel that way,
mm-hmm,
in a space that's far more consequential in terms of, you know, your long-term trajectory. Like, if you're able to navigate that space effectively, you can really make some things happen, not for the next 4 years of your life, but for the next 40. So, that was my mission on a broader level. Okay, I'm proving a point to myself here, and it's not something I believed I could do, because I didn't think I was as smart as any of those kids. I didn't think I belonged in that space. I was like, I finessed the system to get me in here. I was just lucky enough to trick these motherfuckers to let me in.
The almighty finesse. Go ahead.
Yeah, the almighty finesse. Yeah. I think that's a great tagline right there.
Yeah.
I like that right there. The almighty finesse. Yeah, man. So the way I approached my time at Yale was twofold. It was like, okay, I'm here to prove something to myself on a personal level. I'm also here to make this campus more accessible, mm-hmm, for people like me. And I committed my energy, as much of my energy as I could possibly muster, to that latter goal. And I think the fulfillment of those personal ambitions came out of me doing something that I was genuinely passionate about. And that's all the work I did on campus.
And a lot of this, as I've seen it, and I'm sure you may be able to attest to also, is that the more that you move or veer towards what you call a crew privilege, or just kind of being in spaces that you never saw yourself as being able to or suitable for, that you are in a way forcibly isolating yourself. One, because you have to, because the people and kind of a lot of where you come from, a lot of that home base, even if it's not literally home, that home-like familiarity won't get it, can't get it because they haven't seen it.
Right.
Not that they're not capable, it's just not in their purview.
Yeah.
What does that isolation feel like for you? Did it feel isolating, and how did you work through it?
It did feel isolating in a way. There were experiences I just couldn't really talk to anybody in my close family life about. My mom didn't go to college. She took night classes for a little bit and then ended up deciding to just go work instead. Same thing with my grandmother. Those are my two family members I'm closest to. It felt extraordinarily isolating, but I do think that I was very lucky in the sense that I fell into a community of people who came from very similar backgrounds. So a lot of my closest friends at the university were also experiencing that same type of isolation. Mm-hmm. And it was through that group solidarity that I was able to make sense of that experience and navigate it. I think that's one of the things I'm actually very grateful to that campus for. I don't think that exists everywhere. I was lucky to fall into a space, to stumble into a space where that did exist, relative to how that relates to back home. Because they know how I came up, right? I came up very visibly as somebody who was good at basketball in particular in that city. Mm-hmm. It's a very visible thing at the high school level. So I think people saw the full arc of my trajectory and felt pride for me. People from my community, right? They felt pride for me. So it wasn't one of those things where I come back home and people are like, oh man, you so out of touch. You don't think you are, who you think you is. Like, you not switched on it. Like, it was none of that. It was like, yo, talk to us about how that is. Oh, what? Yo, like, you got to sit in class with that? I don't even know who that is. Who is that? I'm so serious. We started having conversations about this stuff. And I never felt completely severed from that world because of the space that I had walked into, right? And I was very intentional about trying to make sure that I didn't sever myself from that world. That said, I mean, being 3,000 miles away has an effect, right? It's hard to maintain relationships. It takes its toll at the level of relationships, but in terms of that visceral connection with a place and its people, I don't think that's ever left me. Even all the way out here in England, I don't think that ever leaves me. I still feel that same throbbing in my chest when I think about the concept of home and the people that comprise the place that I call home.
What do you believe in?
What do I believe in? Fundamentally, I believe in people. I believe in building a redemptive society, a society that makes room for people to err and to fuck up, to fall short, and then, you know, steps in and provides those people with the resources, with the support, with the love and care, the community that they need in order to grow, to heal, and to move forward. Mm. I think that's probably the most fundamental concept I believe in, redemption.
Back on Sunday, July 5th, part 2.